Good evening, everybody, or good afternoon, depending upon where you are in the world. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona, and thanks for tuning in. It's a real pleasure and an honor to have our longtime friend, Michael McGarrity. I was kind of going down memory lane about, the very first book that came out, took the Southwestern literary world by storm back in 1996. And I remember it being at your very first event here at the Poison Pen when I was a lad of 12 and in sixth grade.
Great. There's a lot enough to read.
On Main Street. It was before you moved. It was in the old store on Main Street.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It sure was. And we didn't move to this store in 99, but we had moved one store. So you got to the original store was like a closet. So you got to a slightly bigger store, but we probably went somewhere else to have the event because we didn't have any space in the store to do it.
No, it was in the store. I remember.
Really?
Yeah. And I signed
I find that hard to believe because usually we walk down to another bookstore right down the street.
You might have signed in the store, but I remember distinctly there being a circle. There was a circle of us at Tom Swinford's old store. But then, Michael, you're quite right. You signed the books at the bookstore itself. We just did the interview down there.
We had this gypsy-like thing we did with a used bookstore down the street. And he was really kind and let us use his floor space in the evenings because he wasn't open. And we did that for quite a few years. And then we moved in 99 to where we currently are and where we've had barbecue with Michael. We've had all kinds of nifty.
Right. So it's a beautiful store. I love your store.
Well, thank you. And we love the Kevin Kearney books. We're always among our bestsellers. And then Michael wrote three books about the history of the Kearney family, which were wonderful. And his new book that we're going to talk about gives a little time to Kevin's wife, Sarah's family. Although Sarah does not make an actual appearance. She's merely kind of out there as a potential of life, but we know it's her. Now I have, as Patrick showed you, mine's got a reflective cover on it, the copy of Tularosa. But I also have my British copy. And look how different it is, even with the glare on it. See the Southwest colors and the entire difference. Great. So Michael published two, or was it three books with Norton originally? It was this one and Mexican Hat. Was it just those two?
Just those two.
Right. Yeah. I didn't bring my Mexican Hat in, but I have those. And I love the covers. And I think it's wonderful that Michael has gone full circle via Simon & Schuster and Dutton all the way back to W.W. Norton, which is a very great quality, very high quality independent publisher and a nice home.
Last one standing, right?
Just about. Yeah. Nice.
But it's going to continue to stand because the people that work there own the company and they have a fierce independence about what they do and how to do it. And they're brilliant at it.
Yeah. And we have a wonderful sales rep. I mean, he's super active. Whenever I ask him for anything, he can always do it. He's not constrained by corporate, kinds of issues and so forth. And anyway, we love working with Norton. And I'm happy to say that they are doing a little more fiction than they used to, which is good news for us. Because we are, as those of you who are watching know, primarily a fiction bookstore. We do some nonfiction. Patrick is really into true crime. And so he's doing an increasing number. He has an exciting one coming up in July, don't you, Patrick?
Her name is Jillian Loren. And it's about the most prolific serial killer in American history. And she developed a relationship with him in prison, talking to him. And during the course of that, not to go on, but she got him to confess to dozens more murders that he had never been caught for. So it's incredible story.
There's a lot more true crime, and part of that is the engineering of podcast podcasts are taking us back to old time radio. And it really is. It's the same sort of thing all over again where we're listening to stuff. But a lot of podcasting feeds off true crime, and a lot of podcasters are now writing crime fiction. So it's kind of an interesting circle.
Well, you know, good narrative nonfiction is just as exciting as a good mystery or a good crime novel or a good police procedural. It can be just as grabbing. As a matter of fact, I tend to lean in that direction more than wanting to read within the various different genres that I write in. So I'm with Patrick. I like that stuff.
But you kind of write almost narrative nonfiction, in that your crime fiction has always been fact-based in the sense, you know, the landscapes are authentic, and you're a former lawman, which we should mention. So, you know, you really understand police procedure and how stuff works. In this book, we're going to be talking about the Army, because that's been, the armed forces anyway, play a big role in this, and the whole kind of support of brothers in the service and that kind of thing. But I think, Michael, you know, that your own professional background, you know, gives your books extra authenticity. What brought you to writing at all, considering that you were in personal lawman?
I don't know. It was kind of like a challenge. I challenged myself. I said one summer, after I'd spent 2.5 years working with chronically mentally ill patients in a really intensive setting, that I needed to take some time off. And my bride of 60 years, we made 60 this year, said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'll try to write a book." So I sat down with my Big Chief tablet and my pen, and I wrote a really terrible book, a really terrible story. But it was so much fun, I didn't want to stop. So I got caught up in the process of learning how to become a writer. And through that experience, I was able to eventually attract the attention of a young editor at W.W. Norton, who thought I had some potential and said, "I'll look at anything you write. I can't buy your book now, but I'll look at anything you write." So I thought, well, that's a great offer. How many people get an offer from a New York editor at an established publishing house that they would be willing to look at your work? So I just kept at it. And it grew and it grew and it grew into a career. So that's how it all started. And it's still going on today.
It really is. And I love the way that you have, you know, not reinvented, but you've tackled new projects. This will be the third one that I'm familiar with. I'm also looking at my copy of Death Song, which is 11 in the Kevin Kearney series. And I think this one pretty much wraps it up, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't wrap up the Kearney series.
Okay, so this is as far as my own books went. So somehow I slipped up. How much farther did you go?
Well, I went, there were two more books. There was Residue, which sort of brought the past back to Kearney in a very upsetting, difficult way, because he became accused of a crime, of the death of a co-ed that he had known when he was a young college student before he ever went to NAM. And then in Head Wounds, I pretty much wrapped it up with a borderland look at the crime syndicate in Mexico, the drug lords, the corrupt police officers, and a tribe of remote Kickapoo Indians who have lived in northern Mexico for the last 150 years. And so that wound up the Kearney series. People were very upset, which I took as a great compliment, because they wanted it to continue. They wanted me to continue with the Native American character that I had brought into the picture in the Judas Judge, who was Kearney's half Apache son. And I said, no, I need to absolutely step away. And so the next thing I wanted to do was to keep the family thread that is woven throughout the books going, with the spinoff that deals with Kearney's wife's family antecedents. And that's what the long ago does.
Right. Well, and I mentioned there's three books about Kearney's family himself in the Tularosa Basin and forth, which span a really long period of time and were they were conceived and written as a trilogy, right? With a long story arc.
Well, they started out as it was just going to be a one-off prequel.
Really?
Yeah. And I went back to my editor at Dutton and I said, I'm really having a hard time putting this all into one book. And he said, well, what'd you like to do? I said, well, maybe two books. And he said, well, send me what you got. And he looked at it. He said, I think three books would be better. And I said, you got it. We'll do a trilogy. And so Brian Tart, who had started out as a young editor and had worked on Lewis L'Amour and had an affinity for what I was trying to do in terms of a historical Western trilogy, got behind it 100%. And so it morphed into that. And I kept thinking to myself as I was writing it, can I do this? Can I really pull this off? And then Hard Country, the first book in the trilogy, comes out. And I said, wow, that's a relief. And it hit the New York Times bestseller list and it got a lot of favorable attention. And then I went back and I said, oh my God, I got to do this two more times. And it all worked out that I was able to pull it off. And at the time that The Last Ranch, the final book in the trilogy, published, I lost my editor, who was also the publisher at Dutton at the time. He went on to Viking. And I moved away from my agent. And with that happening, I took a look at what's going on with the early sales with Norton. And I kept getting these very nice royalty checks because I had sold those two books without an agent. So the money came directly to me out of the royalties. Well, I found a wonderful new agent who I had known for many years and who wanted to represent me early in my career. And I told her, why don't you go back and see if Norton might be interested in renewing our friendship, so to speak. And one thing led to the other. And this is my third book with Norton. I'm under contract with a fourth that I'm about a third into. And even though I'm going to be 83 years old in 3 weeks, I'm still going strong.
Well, here we both are. Right. So anyway, I'm delighted. And Patrick and I laugh because for years, we could order Tularosa in hardcover from Norton. You know, don't you remember that, Patrick? We used to talk about that.
Yeah, they still had seemed to have a little stash of them.
You still can. Believe it or not, Norton is still selling first edition Tularosas.
Really? That's astonishing. And then the second book too, Mexican Hat?
I don't think so. I think it's just Tularosa.
Might just be Tularosa. Well, since I am, Michael's book is our historical fiction book of the month for July. And as a result, we've pretty much sold it out. Whoop, wrong book. Sorry, got too many here. So I'm going to send him a new batch to sign and meet up with him in Santa Fe week after next and bring them back. But you know what? I'm going to see if they indeed can include some Tularosa. Why not? I mean, yes, get it. You know, I might as well add some Tularosa to the shipment. That would be great.
Well, every time I get a royalty statement, I see that they're selling Tularosa in hardback.
Well, I love that. I really do. And, you know, basically, I mean, it's true that we've moved on in time, but it's really an ageless story. And I don't think that the passage of years means that Tularosa is not still a wonderful book. And one of the things that I have always loved about Michael's works is that New Mexico is a character. In the same way they had the Navajo reservations character in the Hillerman books or in Stephen Hamill's The Boot Evil of New Mexico. I don't know what it is about New Mexico. You guys kind of divided it up, maybe almost unintentionally. So Hamill gets the Boot Evil and you get Santa Fe and kind of all over. And Tony and now his daughter Anne have the Navajo reservation, which of course is outside of New Mexico.
The Four Corners. But with the new book with the long ago, I've skipped town.
You have, all the way to California.
I'm in Montana, I'm in San Francisco, I'm at Fort Ord, I'm in Los Angeles, I'm at Thousand Oaks, I'm in Sierra Madre, I'm in all these places that I had a hell of a lot of experiences with in my own early years. So although it's not autobiographical, I was able to pull on a lot of memories of the way places looked back in the early 1960s, how Los Angeles was, how San Francisco was, what it was like to be part of the Army at that point before there was the end of subscription and the creation of the Volunteer Professional Army Corps. So all of those things kind of filtered into the story in a very interesting way. And I'm just quite excited about it because it kind of cuts across the genres. I mean, you can call it an amateur detective. You can call it a police procedural novel because the mystery is right in your face from almost page one, where it's a young man coming home from Vietnam in the early days of that conflict before it's even on everybody's consciousness that there's a war going on over there, searching for his sister who has gone missing. And that's really what the story is about. And to make it work, I think I have a plethora of very interesting supporting characters in this book that are just fun. Like the police detective for the LAPD.
Yeah.
It's a sergeant. And he's just fun. He's just this great kind of character. And Ray Lansdale, my protagonist's uncle, this solid Montana sheriff with a heart of gold, and his wife are just, I think they just really come alive on the page. So I'm very excited about this book because I think it takes a reader on a journey that many people in our generation would be able to relate to in terms of setting and time and environment and what's happening in the world and the characters themselves as the story kind of reveals itself over time. So I really had a good time with this book. It was kind of one of my more fun but more difficult stories to write.
Well, I can speak almost uniquely perhaps as a bookseller because I was still at Stanford in 1963 when this story opens and well remember Ford Ord and all of that. So, and how it looked and how it felt. I wasn't in Montana, but definitely the San Francisco area scenes, I think, and even Los Angeles certainly brought back that time in my life to me. You've already figured out that Michael and I are only 6 months apart in age. So, you know, we're not having a problem keeping up with that. But, you know, and Michael doesn't pontificate, but there are some moments where he says some really, I think, true things that were for then and for now. On page 93, for example, when there's a discussion going on and somebody says, how does crap like this happen? Steve shrugged. Some people are born victims, and some people are born bad, which I think is absolutely true. I think it's always been true. I mean, I think if you read Dickens, for example, and great, you know, Oliver Twist, how come some of them do well and some of them, you know, turn into crooks and whatever it is? I mean, the whole nature versus nurture argument still goes on. But I do think there are people who are just born bad. And Patrick, you know, you referenced earlier the prolific serial killer, you know?
Yeah.
I think you almost have to agree that he was born bad. I don't know.
Well, either, I think there are lovely little touches in this story when Steve is learning about Ray and he's learning, Steve, the cop from LA, is learning about Ray, learning about his high school buddy, Dean, who comes in later. But it's like, he's learning that these guys not only played football, but they were on the debate team, that they weren't just thinking about girls and football and high school. They were thinking about things like D.H. Lawrence or Huxley. And he keeps saying things like, what do they have in the water in Montana? How do they teach these kids these things? And the reason I brought that to play is because back in the day, it was not unusual for rural students, for students in high school in rural communities to have that kind of an exposure.
Right.
It was not unusual. And so this is kind of startling to this urban, sophisticated cop to meet these young men who have a breadth of knowledge that he didn't expect them to have. And I think that's a really nice touch in the story.
I think it's a nice touch in the story too. Now, having talked about sort of determinism, how we're born or whatever, I think Michael also illustrates the role of chance in people's lives. And it's particularly true with Private E1 Doyle R. Crawford, who was a veterinarian, and he gets, you know, drafted into Vietnam. And, you know, the idea was that he would go in as a dog handler, an infirman dog handler. And instead, he runs into a guy who kind of casually looks it over and decides that, well, you tell us, he decides that he's not going to be given his specialty. And then somebody else passes the paper on, who's, you know, just a short timer about to get out of the Army. New war is on the horizon. You say he prepared the paperwork for his transfer to inactive Army Reserve status and meant he'd never have to wear the uniform again. Hallelujah. So these two guys really warp the whole trajectory of Doyle's life.
Right. Is it a circumstance, an accident? All of these things can happen in life that you have absolutely no control over. And later in the story, something disastrous happens as a consequence of a simple decision made by this young man to do something that he didn't have to do if he didn't want to do it. And so there's that accidental nature to life that I think we all have experienced. I can't think of a situation, an important situation in my life, where something totally unexpected took me on a different trajectory, whether it was professionally or even whether it was as a writer. When you reach a juncture and you say, what am I going to do? What's next? What decisions am I going to make? And I think this book is filled with a lot of examples of that. Both Ray and Barbara, the kid sister he's looking for, make decisions. And as a consequence, all kinds of things start to happen that never would have happened otherwise. And I think that's one of the touchstones of this story.
Oh, well, no, I definitely agree with you. But let's tell people about Ray and Barbara and their childhood and why it is that Barbara has disappeared and Ray wants to find her.
Well, it's a total dysfunctional family. There's an alcoholic father and a mentally ill mother that are constantly at each other. The title, The Long Ago, comes from this fantasy that Barbara and Ray create as young children. That's a safe place where they can emotionally get away from all of that. And that's what drives Ray into the Army. I mean, Steve, the cop, says, well, why didn't you become a Marine like your uncle and like I was? And he said, because the Army basically was the first bus out of town. And Steve said, yeah, I can understand that. In Barbara's case, it gets more complex because of the dysfunction of her father after Ray has already left the scene and joined the Army, where he finds out, hey, this may be the right place for me. This may be a place where I can become the man I want to be. And so those factors figure into Ray's leaving and Barbara's disappearance. And if you read carefully, you find out that Barbara does more than disappear when it comes to dealing with her father.
Yeah.
And that has a huge psychological effect on her in terms of, does she ever really think that she wants to be found?
And there are moments when, you know, you think that they will. I mean, there are moments when they almost come together.
That's right.
There's just a very sort of membrane that separates them and keeps them so far apart. I mean, it's a very long quest, you know, to go on over the course of the book. Is, will Ray ever find Barbara? Will Barbara still be alive when he gets there? Will he die on the quest and Barbara will never know he looked for her? Are all kinds of questions that that come up. But what I found so interesting was the support. One of the things I really loved was the support system that exists for Ray among, people who've been in either the law enforcement or the armed services. He gets a lot of help from people.
He does.
He couldn't commandeer. It has to be volunteered by these people.
It does. There's a camaraderie to military service that is kind of fading from view in terms of the civilian soldier that we used to have in this country. That's no longer the case, but there's still a connection between people who have served, and those are the kind of people that will step up on your behalf. The first character that you encounter in the long ago is Al, the garage owner, the World War II vet who let Ray work on his little Ford coupe while he was in high school, and then stored it for him when he went off into the army. And so there's people like Al who's there who can take a look at this young man and say, I think he's grown up. I'm not quite sure yet. I'm going to keep my eye on him, but he looks like he's maybe turning into a young man with some substance. So there's people like that. There's his uncle, a Marine Corps veteran from World War II in the South Pacific, wearing the Navy Cross, the second highest award that you can get for military heroism, who's also looking out after not only him, but Barbara, as best he can. And then you bring in the law enforcement people. You bring in Steve and his story. And one of the things that I love best about Steve is the fact he's got this backstory that his father was a senior animator for Walt Disney and one of Walt Disney's friends. And so you've got that little tickle of an idea that you can play with later on in the narrative towards the end of the book. And so all that stuff sort of coalesced and worked. And I think it ties into your point about how, yeah, Ray gets support, but he gets support because in a way he's earned it. He's earned the support.
Well, he's earned his way into this kind of band of brotherhood, so to speak. You know, interestingly, Disneyland opened in, what was it, 59, I think? Right around now. Yeah. I remember going to a Stanford game, Stanford UCLA, I think, or maybe it was Southern California. And we went down there, and then after the game, we all went to Disneyland, and it was out there in the middle of orange groves. There was barely a paved road. There was absolutely nothing around it, and people were going, seriously, is this really going to work? I've always admired Walt Disney because I think, you know, there were many things about him apparently that were fairly ruthless, although, you know, who cares? Yeah. I mean, if you didn't have to work with him. But he really had vision, and he had the guts to back it up.
He did.
Absolutely true. So it is a multi-layered story. And another takeaway from it is that even without technology, without cell phones, without social media, all of the rest of this, it's amazing how these people over long distances really stayed connected. And because the world was smaller, they weren't just a statistic to each other. You know, they were real people to each other, and they managed to connect. You know, the mail used to, you know, be more heavily used in these situations.
I know.
Letters have apparently gone up to 66 cents. I just noticed that. You know, I was like, wow.
But it was a lot of fun to bring that technological era to life in terms of how people had to communicate, what they had to do. Like there's Ray back in Vietnam trying to get a hold of Steve, and he's got to do it through a system called MARS, which was a military patch job with phones that you could set up and use, but you could only use it like for 5 minutes to try to make a telephone call using this volunteer system that the Army provided. So there's little things like that that were kind of fun to recreate and bring back to life.
You know, I can still remember my grandmother's phone number. I mean, we had 4-digit phone numbers. And I love the bookstore because the bookstore's number is 2974. My grandmother's number was 1974. I always thought it was kind of interesting that it worked out that way. And, you know, I mean, it's been, you know, 70 some years since I used that number. But when you're young, that kind of thing really sticks in your head. We actually knew people's phone numbers and all. And now, you know, with cell phones, nobody knows an actual phone number anymore. Do you know my phone number, Patrick?
I know your home number because it predates cell phones. And so it's etched in my
brain. Still has a landline?
Okay. No, we don't have a landline anymore. No. But I mean, it's really, most of the time, you don't have any idea what anybody's number is anymore. Plus, it's expanded to.
I almost just spewed it out and told the world what your phone number was. I'm glad I didn't do that.
No, I could change it. All I'm saying is that, you know, people, I mean, we were more, it took a little more work, but we were in many ways more intimately connected than we are today when it's all just punching buttons on a phone and all the rest of it.
I love maps too.
Well, you know, because I've had this hand surgery and I can only type with one finger, I've had to do some business the last couple of days by calling people because, I mean, I can't type a complicated issue that needs discussion. And it's been interesting, you know, to actually talk to people instead of, you know, emojis. And I called Michael because I thought and it turned out I was right. I'd forgotten to send him the link to talk to him this afternoon. So I sent it to him and then I thought, you know, I can't just rely on email. I need to call him because he may decide that it's lost in his email and get all upset or whatever. So we had a nice little visit on the phone. And, you know, in many respects in our daily life, we've forgotten how to do that. You know,
we had some friends come over, new friends, people that we met, and we got an actual thank you card in the mail. You know, and it was just, these are not people of our generation, Barbara. As a matter of fact, they're half our age. And it was just so delightful that these two people in their early 40s, late 30s, knew enough, felt good enough about their evening with us to send an actual thank you card through the mail. And we do that. I don't know if you do it. But we do that when we go out and are entertained by friends. We send little notes. And I don't like the idea of that all going away. I don't think it should all go away.
Yeah, well, sometimes it's impractical. I try to send actual cards on special occasions to my family and, you know, some cards of Christmas and so forth. But I'm embarrassed. I get thank you notes from authors who've come to the store. I got a lovely one from Megan Abbott. Patrick, and I wrote her back and I said, you know, thank you for your beautiful card. And I wish that I were going to write you back a thank you, but here's a So I felt kind of like a jerk, but so it is. I think it's important to, you know, to try to keep those things going. So remind us again, The Long Ago is a great title for this book on many, many levels. I mean, obviously, it's taking you back to the 1960s, which Michael and I are horrified to now know is regarded as historical fiction because our lives, you know, I hate the fact. I mean, I keep thinking, you know, it was an interesting thing. When we started the bookstore in 1989, I don't know if Patrick remembers because he's been there almost that long. The 1920s was the threshold of historical fiction. You know, if it were later than the 1920s, didn't really count. And then we got to the 90s and it kind of moved up to the 1930s. But I realized last year when Larry King wrote a book set in the late 60s and 70, early 70s in California, that it was now 50 years. The same gap had existed before, it just had advanced all that way. And this book is 1963 to 65 qualifies as historical fiction, which it would not have done when the store started. So.
See, I've crossed into another genre.
Well,
think about the 50-year gap before those two you mentioned. You're back in the frontier era.
That's right.
Yeah.
Within living memory, you know. Yeah,
my grandparents were born in the 1890s, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and my parents were children of the 20s and the Depression. And that's only, you know, one generation up for me.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So
I think who was walking around when they were kids, you know?
Yeah, Civil War, whatever. Yeah,
it's amazing.
They had a thing in the Carl Rove, not a columnist that I love, I subscribe to the Wall Street Journal for the arts coverage, not for the editorial content, but, and they do a great job with books and arts and so forth. But every once in a while, I read a piece by Karl Rove, who's a Republican columnist. And he was not writing as a Republican. He was writing to say that there have been these periods with presidencies where there's like an age group, and then that doesn't hold, and then we go to another age group. He was talking about the fact that everybody is old right at the moment at higher levels of government. And then he reminded us that after Eisenhower, we got Kennedy. And Eisenhower had been of a certain age, and Kennedy, we dropped back to 43, and it stayed young for a little while and then got older again. I didn't know that George H. Bush, at the age of 18, was the youngest combat pilot in our armed services during World War II. Yeah. 18 years old. Wow.
Right.
But, you know, by the time we elected him president and so forth, you know, he was older. But anyway, Rove's point going all the way back was that there are generational shifts, but they're not necessarily younger. Sometimes we get a cluster of younger, sometimes we get a cluster of older. And, you know, he was more or less writing to say that the electorate needs to make a push to change things because we've had a cluster of old for too long.
Here we are, we're part of that cluster.
Well, but you and I are not running the country, which I think is really too bad, because we probably could do it. But nonetheless, I thought it was an interesting idea, you know, that age is defined differently for different purposes, and it can come in clusters. So there we are. Anyway, we won't tell you whether Ray successfully finds his sister Barbara. What happens to Barbara's husband, the veterinarian, and why it is that there is a link to Kevin Kearney's wife, Sarah. You'll have to read it.
You won't find that out until you get to the last page.
That's right. I love the way you did it, too. It was
really I have a question or two for Michael.
Absolutely.
When did, you set the book partly in the early days of Vietnam. When did it really get cooking? It was in 60, you know.
It really started to heat up around 65.
65,
It was getting national attention. You have to remember, Patrick, this was an era where there was something called national magazines. There was Life, there was Look. They were basically a combination of photographs, photojournalism, and reporting. And so in the early 60s, there started to be more and more stories that would come out in these national magazines about the problems that were going on in Vietnam. Early on, we were just advisors. We were just there to help the South build up an army so that they could overcome communism. What most people don't know, and it's not in the book, but I love to tell the story. Ho Chi Minh in 1949 approached the West and asked for their help and got turned down. And so here was this man who managed to pull off an enormous coup by defeating the world's most powerful army, who originally started out at the end of World War II wanting to connect with Western powers and utilize their knowledge and skill to build a new society for his people in Vietnam. That aside, which is really a huge mistake on our part not to take advantage of it, that aside, in the early 60s, it was just a hot spot. It wasn't a place where we were considering any kind of major expansion or major involvement. We would just give them military assistance. We would give them money. We would give them training. We would help them with pacification. We would help them set up communications and learn how to use new technology and new armaments. So it was in the media, but people weren't worried about it.
When did we propped up Diem and then did the coup. When was that? Was that early 60s, wasn't it?
It was more or less closer to mid-60s.
Was it mid-60s?
Okay. Yeah, because my first husband, Patrick, went down to Fort Ord from Stanford and became a Green Beret, but they were, you know, just then beginning to train things. But what I learned having gone to Vietnam maybe 10 or 12 years ago and going to their war museum was a real surprise, because they hardly even recognize what they call the American War. It's a blip for them. Their longtime constant millennial foe is China. Yeah. And that's what Ho Chi Minh wanted, you know, to kind of get his act together. The French had withdrawn and left a vacuum, and he didn't really want the Chinese to once again swoop down. So he approached us and we ignored it. It's, you know, it's the same mentality that turned down the guy that wanted to do, you know, manufacture chips here in the United States. And we said no. So he went to Taiwan and yeah. established Taiwan as like the major chip producer or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And now there they are trying to figure out if they want to be Hong Kong or the Ukraine, as was brought in today, because probably they're going to have to make a decision one way or the other. We, you know, our policies have not been consistently brilliant when it comes to making decisions.
Looking backwards, it's always easier to say, well,
of course it is. But my question has always been about the Vietnam War. My question has always been, what were we going to do with Vietnam if we won the war? What were we going to do with it? You know, it's too far away to not belong.
I don't think we had an idea. I mean, there have been some really great nonfiction historical analysis of Vietnam, and I did a lot of reading on that, and because I was very interested in making sure that I got things right. And it's still today a topic that's being discussed. It hasn't faded from view. We know we messed up, and a lot of people thought, well, maybe we learned our lesson. But guess what? No, we didn't learn our lesson. We went right back at the same old stuff and messed up again and again. So I'm not too sure that we're the best and the brightest when it comes to solving problems of other nations, especially when we want to use arms to do it.
There was that, you know, that Ken Burns documentary series on Vietnam, which was good. They interviewed North Vietnamese soldiers, NVA, mm-hmm. and which I thought was nice balanced approach. But one of the most insightful things was this North Vietnamese soldier said, you know, the Americans they didn't understand. You know, they thought that they were fighting communism. We thought we were fighting a civil war.
You know. Yeah, no, I think that's true. As I said, if you go to their war museum in Hanoi, you can see that in this great big museum where there's, you know, different sections, the section about the American War is almost like a closet compared to the panoply of, you know, and again, it's really mostly about China. And a huge number of Chinese who fled communist China went to Vietnam.
You know. Yeah, I think your point can be stated in a slightly different way, and that is that for us, it's a real festering wound that is yet to heal, and I don't know if it can heal. So it's our burden that we carry, and I think the Vietnamese have moved on.
Oh, absolutely.
We're going to make your new tennis shoes. We're going to
They're a thriving capitalist society.
Or that's right.
Capitalist economy. Yeah. No question about it.
Yeah,
so.
Absolutely. So, but it's
anyway. It's not. But you're right. It was a self-inflicted wound that drove our country apart, and I think really shattered the whole sort of, you know, the American society that was forged in World War II and all. It splintered. Over Vietnam, and we haven't ever recovered from it.
No, I don't think we have.
Still in the middle of it. It destroyed a kind of a American consensus that we have.
One of the things that I enjoyed doing in this book was to give a little a little portrait of what it was like when the army was filled with civilian soldiers, the old army, with these old master sergeants who were connected to one another with that whole network that existed back when the professional soldier was really the smallest part of the army, because there were all of these draftees and conscripts and enlistees who were serving in post-Korea military units. And so I have a couple of these old master sergeants in the story that are connected to each other in a way that no longer exists, I think, with the professional military the way it is. It may, I don't know, but it was kind of fun to bring them back to life.
Yeah, no, there's just wonderful stuff all the way through the book. Patrick, do we have any questions from the audience?
Yeah. First of all, I wanted to ask, sorry about this flashing, real quickly, is it possible, I mean, to actually trace the any autobiographical elements in the book, or is it just the entire fabric of the story is kind of, you know, soaked in your autobiography and all the attitudes and...
Yeah. Well, you know, the autobiography is never going to be written, Patrick, I'm afraid. I'm not interested in that. I used to say that there was nothing autobiographical in anything that I wrote. And, you know, that was wrong, because when you learn about a land, when you learn about a place, when you learn about people, you put part of your observation, your experience into that. So, what the writer brings, I think, that makes a story work is experience. I mean, that's how the modern novel was born. It was born on the back of explorers and scientists and geologists and people who were studying plants and were going to foreign places that nobody had ever visited before. And they came back and basically created the new modern novel. And that tradition continues today. And for those writers out there who have their masters in creative writing, and have never done anything other than get a master's in creative writing, it's going to be terribly hard to tell a good story until they get a little bit wet behind the ears. And I see a lot of fiction out there that has this wonderful internal state about, well, I can deal with all the psychological stuff from the trauma, all the social things about how people relate and how they don't relate, and I can create a story and it bores me to death. If that's all they can bring to the table as writers, they're not making it. So that's my rant. If you want a rant from McGarrity, that's my rant. For a writer to really make a mark on me as somebody who can take in what they want to say, I've got to feel that they know exactly what they're talking about and they're not just making it up.
Let's see.
End of rant.
No, it's a good rant.
It is a good rant.
I mean, you worked for years in the prison systems, right? And I know a little bit about your background, not everything. But what were some of the highlights of your law enforcement career?
Well, you bring up prison. Actually, I took over the mental health program at the penitentiary of New Mexico after the riot of 1980. So I'd walked in the door before then. I'd gone in and been an instructor in the old prison for the College of Santa Fe. I was an assistant professor. But when the riot broke out in 1980 and dozens of people got killed and more got wounded and there were fires, and I can describe to you what I saw, and you would not want to see it on the page. You would not want to see it on the page. There's some things that are better not written about, or they can be talked about, but probably not in the detail that they might ordinarily deserve. Anyway, a prison story for you was, I was a deputy sheriff for the Santa Fe County, and we had a detention center off Airport Road. It was a fairly new place. We were a small department, and we had a staff walkout. We had a staff shutdown. We had the staff locking everything down, not letting anybody in, not letting cops bring prisoners in, not letting anybody out, not letting visitors come in. The sheriff came to me and he said, McGarrity, you worked a little bit with that prison thing. I want you to go in and solve this problem for me. Deputy McGarrity, would you please do that? So I go in solo to a detention center where the entire staff is hostile to my presence, charged with the responsibility of taking it over, of reclaiming it for the County of Santa Fe and the Sheriff's Department, along with a prison population that was throwing fits about not getting the services, the meals, all of the ancillary things that they should be getting. I went into that place and violated one of the first principles that you have in a prison. I went in with a boot gun to that prison because I was not going to go in any other way. And it took me 3 weeks to clean it up. It took me 3 weeks to fire some people, bring some people in, get things back to normal. And I came out of it with a thank you and a commendation and a promotion. So was it risky business? Yeah. Was it scarier than shit? Yeah. Did it need to be done? I was asked to do it. I did it and I survived it. It's still to this day one of the most frightening experiences I had for 3 weeks of my life.
It seems like most, you know, most cops and most soldiers, certainly, that are in combat vets, have seen things that they can never unsee, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
It's true. Anyway, there's an example of what I was talking about.
One of the questions harkens, and I'm actually curious about this too. You mentioned in passing the Kickapoo branch of the Kickapoo tribe in far northeastern New Mexico. Is that
Mexico?
Where, yeah. Well, I didn't realize that they were there. I knew the Hickory Apaches were up there and Kiowas. And
well, that was really part of the reason why I wrote Head Wounds, because I was so entranced by the history of this tribe that actually had migrated out of northern Michigan into the plains and been chased down the plains and became enemies with the Apache, and then voluntarily decided to move the whole tribe into northern Mexico, where the government actually gave them a reservation, and they're still there and they still live on it. Now, what has happened recently in the 90s is Texas granted the Kickapoos a small reservation just on the U.S. side of the border. And so they now have this thriving community in Texas, where they have a casino and they have people working there and they're creating jobs and building houses and infrastructure. But originally, this was a forgotten tribe that lived in total isolation, forgotten in northern Mexico. And I couldn't resist that. I had to tell that story. And the only way to tell that story was to create a character, if you will, a very interesting character who could basically bring the narrative along through who he is and what he does. And so that's how Head Wounds got born.
Boy, I missed that one. I'm gonna have to go back and read that. That sounds fantastic. Yeah, I've always been interested in the mythic lost band of Apaches who never surrendered and went into the Sierra Madre.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's still a
depredations into the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
Fascinating. And a Confederate general allegedly who disappeared into Mexico with a group of soldiers. There's so many interesting, odd stories.
And then there's the Irish Brigade that.
The San Patricios.
Yeah, during the Mexican-American War that disappeared into Mexico and joined the fight against Americans.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, look at the rich history that I was able to draw on. I mean, there's still so much more of it out there that I could do. I need another 83 years.
Well, I remember in the, you know, and then we'll take it in for a landing here, but I remember in the very first book, Tula Rosa, if I'm not mistaken, there was a hidden cache of weapons that the Apaches had, you know, secreted away somewhere in the Dragoon Mountains or someplace like that. And you know that that stuff is out there.
Well, what was wonderful about that is there was this absolute incredible Apache chief by the name of Nana, who was brilliant at ambushing military transport trains, the wagon trains filled with military armament. And there's a story about the Tularosa Basin, Victoria Peak, where there's supposedly Spanish gold that's still to be found in the mountains of the Tularosa Basin. I didn't want to use that. Instead, I like the idea of the Apaches ripping off all of these armaments that belong to the Pony soldiers, stashing them in this hidden cave, and then it being somehow rediscovered, and it's this treasure trove of historical armaments that any museum would absolutely die to have, right? And so that played a part in creating that story. But it was all based on really good historical analysis of what the Apaches were doing on that basin during the Indian Wars.
Yeah, Nana never got the press that Victorio and Mangus Camaradas and all those guys got. But, yeah.
No, we never did.
So yeah. Years ago, I was so enchanted with Michael's descriptions of the Tularosa Basin and all that we decided to drive from Santa Fe down through that area, over to Ruidoso and down to Las Cruces and all on our way home. And the surprise for me was the pistachios. I mean, I love pistachios. Yeah, I had no idea that this was
pistachios.
Somebody's asking if there's a song about Tularosa. I can't think of one. Is there, Michael?
I don't know. You've got me on that one. I'm sure there is.
Yeah, maybe she's thinking of Mendocino.
Mendocino.
Yeah, Sir Douglas Quintet. Great song.
Oh my God, that goes way back.
New Mexico is a truly wondrous state. It is so beautiful and has very distinct areas, and it's not thickly populated so that the local culture survives. They haven't been over by urban and redevelopment. I mean, you know, you can go to Hatch for Chili's, or you can go to Silver City, having driven through the on the.
But we've got a lot of small communities that are kind of
absolutely so. And you know, it's just so beautiful. The skies, particularly I think in northern New Mexico, is just almost.
Well, if you get out of the Rio Grande corridor from Las Cruces all the way north to Taos, if you leave that corridor, because that's where the majority of the population is, all the way up that corridor, you have all these other places that you can explore that very, very few people are willing to do. And you can spend a lifetime doing it. I've spent the last 50 years doing it, last 60 years doing it.
My favorite little excursion train is the one that goes from Chama, New Mexico to Chinitas. There's beautiful ranch country around Chama. There's a gorgeous road from Chama over to Taos. And, you know, it's just, you can go to the Bisti Badlands and feel, you know, I'll sign off with this. This is one of my favorite things, because when I was young, my world was dominated by the Oz books. Those were the first books I read almost. And I really thought the world was divided up into red and green and blue and yellow, and the Emerald City in the middle. I was convinced that if you traveled, you would indeed be in a completely different landscape where you would find different colors in the whole bit. I've never quite gotten over that. So some years ago, we went to Germany. And we had a guide. My husband agreed with me that if we couldn't read the language and couldn't find our way on a map, we should hire a car and a driver, having gotten lost in Japan twice, not following map. So we had a car and a driver, and we ended up in Cappadocia. And I looked around at the gorgeous fairy, whatever they call them, and, you know, people living in stuff and the mesas. And I said to Rob, it's New Mexico. It's a caldera. There are the mesas. There are the Misty Badlands. It's exactly the same as New Mexico west of Santa Fe. And, you know, I was just, it blew away my whole Oz theory that, you know, you could go to different parts of the world and they really weren't different or different colors. Amazing.
We had we have a friend who was born in Africa, English. She's English. She now lives in England, in a small little village, in a guest cottage. But she would come to New Mexico and say, this is like going home to Africa. So, you know, we have a landscape that translates into all sorts of international places. You look at the movie No Country for Old Men. Where was it filmed? A lot of it was filmed in New Mexico. You look at that Jeff Bridges movie that came out recently, where he plays a Texas sheriff, filmed in New Mexico. You look at all these television series that are Westerns. Most of them have been filmed in New Mexico. So we have this landscape that's absolutely wonderful for a range of locales, and you can create them. You could make our state look like Africa. You can make it look like Greece. And what's happening? Hollywood is here, and they're not going away.
Well, New Mexico's offered them some pretty serious tax incentives and other stuff, so it's not totally the landscape. Part of it is right. New Mexico has wanted that. And that reminds me, we failed to ask him the usual question, Patrick, which is there any film interest at all in the Cuban Carney or other books, or is it too early to say?
No, I have, there's a shopping option out there right now with a reputable producer who has some really strong credits as a producer. And there is a script, and there's what they call a Bible that goes with the script, which outlines a series, a limited series, television series. Nothing's happening with it. There haven't been any nibbles. There have been some really important people who've turned it down, but it's still there, and we'll see what happens.
Well, I hope so. The writer's strike means nothing is happening right now, but you know, let's hope for the best, because I've always thought it would make terrific television. And, you know,
this is about the sixth option I've had.
Wonderful. Well, let's hope for the best. Michael, it was really a pleasure. This is such a wonderful book. I really urge you to grab a copy. You don't have to have read anything that Michael has written before to love this book, although if you read it, you'll probably want to read things that Michael has written before. So speak up soon, because when I go to Santa Fe and come back, that's probably the end of our signed copies. So don't hesitate. Michael, what a pleasure to see you. I'll give you a ring when I get there. We'll get together.
See you in a couple of weeks.
Yep, indeed so.
Okay. Thank you, buddy. Thank you, Patrick.
Great to see you.
I love the fact that you guys have been with me on this entire journey.
The entire time. I know. It's amazing. You know.
We'll just keep it going, okay?
All right. I will look forward to it. Thank you, Michael. Bye. Thank you. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.